You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
Oil is and has been since the Industrial Revolution the world's most important commodity. In the future, its importance will, of course, diminish, we know that. But today, it's still the biggest in terms of trading volume and value and is, of course, a key actor in inflation equations and therefore global monetary policy. So the mini demise of oil this year warrants close attention. With me is Mohammed Dokrat, who's an analyst at 91 in Cape Town, and Paul Gooden, portfolio manager at 91 in London. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I've been looking forward to this for several days now, because last week I got very excited looking at an oil graph and said to myself, this doesn't look good. Mohammed, I think Brent crude was above $90 a barrel in April of this year. And a couple of days ago, before we started this podcast, it was below $70 a barrel. Why such nervousness? What are the key factors here?
Yeah, maybe let's start off by saying that I think there's a bit of a disconnect between the physical and the financial or futures markets at present. So the physical market is in deficit, supported by seasonal Northern Hemisphere summer travel demand, as well as supply restrictions from OPEC and sporadic supply disruptions like we're seeing in Libya. And this has resulted in inventory drawdowns over the past few months, and inventory levels are currently below five-year ranges. But despite these supportive fundamentals, the financial markets have turned bearish on oil over the past few weeks, and net positioning is at record lows. And I think the market is primarily worried about substantial supply growth that is expected in 2025. Yeah, so maybe starting on the supply side, which I think has been sort of key driver of the recent sell-off. So non-OPEC supply is set to grow by a substantial 1.5 million barrels per day next year. And this is mainly from the ramp up of very long dated, low cost projects in Guyana, Brazil, Canada, and some US shale growth. And this should cover global demand growth, even under the most optimistic global growth scenarios for next year. In addition to that, OPEC have announced an intention to increase production by about 2 million barrels per day over 12 months starting in December. And the market is basically telling them that this supply is not needed. And so on average, consensus is expecting around 1 million barrels per day surplus in 2025, which is bearish for prices. Just turning to the demand side, demand growth has been robust over the past few years, supported by the post-pandemic normalization in travel. But with that tailwind behind us, demand growth expectations for this year and 2025 are more in line with long-term trend levels, barring a major recession. And most of this growth is expected from emerging economies in Asia, and particularly China, as interest rates come down, the dollar weakens, and economic growth improves. But the market is becoming increasingly concerned about China's economic challenges and the rapid electrification in the transport sector there. And further, declining profitability of gasoline and diesel exports as refining margins have collapsed, and low margins in the petrochemical sector are also contributing to slower crude imports from China, which has obviously got the market a bit worried.
Yeah, the market is a little bit worried. And if I look at my CRB index screen in front of me now, we've got the oil price this year down nearly 24%. We're approaching bear market territory technically. Now, Paul, what about the future? Let's sort of strategize for not just the short term, which Mohammed has very well analyzed, but what's going on? What about shale? What about the energy transition, which is, of course, a reality, but might take a little bit longer than usual? Market share with OPEC and non-OPEC members. There's so many moving parts. What is your assessment?
Yes. Yeah, so I think, you know, shale is kind of central to this. And, you know, over the last decade, US shale has provided 80% of the new barrels that have come to the market. And what you're seeing in US shale is a deceleration in growth. In the go-go years, it would be growing more than 1 million barrels a year, which is a lot of growth because typically oil demand only grows by 1 million barrels a year. So it's basically sucking up all the growth. But because Wall Street is imposing capital discipline on shale E&Ps, and because some of those shale E&Ps are running out of high quality inventory, you're seeing shale growth slow. So this year it'll probably grow by around 400,000 barrels a day. Next year that probably slows to 100,000 or 200,000 barrels a day of year on year growth. And I think probably peak shale is something like 2027. And the reason that the slowdown in shale is important is there's no point in OPEC managing the market is if they keep the oil price relatively high, and shale just sucks up all that growth, which means that OPEC loses share. So the fact that shale is sort of structurally slowing encourages OPEC to manage the market. And I think if OPEC is patient, there are reasons to be relatively optimistic on the oil price on a 3 to 5 year view. But as Mohammed sort of explained, you know, in 25, you know, there's no room for them to bring back barrels. And then kind of on the sort of the demand side, on the energy transition side, you know, one way to think about it is, you know, of the 8 billion people on the planet, there's around a billion, a lucky 1 billion, that consume about 13 barrels a year of oil. And the other 7 billion consume around 3 billion. Now, the global population is going to carry on growing. And in emerging economies, they're going to want to consume more oil. So, you know, in terms of kind of when peak oil demand is, you know, my best guess would be the early 2030s. And, you know, in the last kind of few months, you've seen some third party commentators kind of move out their estimate of when peak demand is, because, you know, EV adoption is kind of lagging versus expectations.
I'm going to stay with you, Paul. Mohammed, we'll come to you in a second. But I've become almost morbidly fascinated with the US election process and also the pronouncements of Trump. It was a little while ago now, 3 or 4 weeks, where he talked about more drilling. I think his phrase was drill, baby, drill. But of course, that's a populist thing to make his rally attendees clap enthusiastically. Is that a likelihood that there will be more fossil fuel extraction potential in the States should Mr. Trump get back into the White House?
Yeah, look, I think you're right to be kind of very kind of skeptical of pronouncements from US politicians in the run-up to elections. It wasn't so long ago Biden was saying no new drilling, period, in the run-up to the last election. And lo and behold, US production has grown quite a lot under the Democrats. So, look, I kind of talked earlier about the, you know, capital discipline being imposed on shale. And I don't think Trump winning, if he does win, and adopting this drill, baby, drill kind of mantra, I don't think it's going to make any difference at all on the oil side. In fact, if anything, I think, you know, Trump is going to be potentially positive for oil prices. I appreciate that's not a consensus view, but that's really related to sort of sanctions on Iran, because the Democrats have gone kind of quite soft on Iranian restrictions. You know, I think Trump's going to get a little bit more draconian, and there potentially could be a million barrels a day of oil that gradually comes off the market if sanctions do get enforced against Iran. The area where I think Trump can make a difference is on natural gas pipelines and infrastructure, because at the moment it's quite difficult to get pipelines built across state lines in the US because the federal government has to approve it. So I think he can make a difference on the natural gas side of things, but frankly, on the oil side of things, I don't think you're going to see a surge in US oil production because Trump wins.
Okay, which from a personal point of view, no, I mustn't say anything about politics. That's beyond this podcast. Mohammed, it seems to me, in my own special layman's way, that the oil price can be a predictor of an economic slowdown or even a recession. And when I see it going down as it did, I think 8% last week at one point, and down nearly 25% in a year, it seems to me that oil traders, who are quite canny fellows, they might be positioning themselves for an economic slowdown or even recession. Am I giving oil too much credence in this regard?
Yeah, I mean, clearly oil prices influence inflation and therefore interest rates, and therefore it can have quite a meaningful impact in global growth. And we have been in a period of very high interest rates, and yet oil prices have remained stubbornly high because of the interventions of OPEC. And so as those interventions start to unwind and the supply growth is coming on next year, I think oil prices are reacting more to that than an economic slowdown. I mean, yes, clearly China is slowing, and you see that across other commodities like in copper, iron ore, etc., where there are significant percentage of global demand. And clearly the worry, as I mentioned earlier, is the transition towards electric vehicles, where, you know, new electric vehicle sales penetration rates hit 45% in China in August. And so, you know, people are quite worried that we are seeing peak demand from the world's second largest consumer and almost the biggest driver of all demand growth over the past decade. And so I guess as their demand starts to tail off, you're sort of worried about what happens to the future oil prices. But there's a natural sort of balancing mechanism that lower prices lead to higher, you know, global demand because manufacturing, logistics, et cetera, becomes more competitive, and therefore that should be supportive for growth.
And Mohammed, I'll give the final question to you. You're an analyst, and it's quite controversial for giant asset management companies to be invested in fossil fuels from an ESG point of view, whether it be via ETFs or via companies that get the stuff out of the ground. What is your policy at 91 towards investing in fossil fuels like oil?
Yeah, thanks. So I think as an overarching house view, you know, we are obviously supportive of the net zero 2050 ambitions, and we are part of the GFANS Alliance, which supports decarbonization. But I think we have taken a more practical approach where we want to see real world emissions reductions and, you know, invest in companies and helping them with their transition towards clean alternatives rather than risking a disorderly transition in a way from fossil fuels. And so there's a strong focus on the high emitting companies in our portfolio and working with them to create credible transition plans that are economically viable so that we get an orderly transition and avoid the sort of pitfall that lack of investment in supply could cause.
Thank you very much for that answer, an honest and very diplomatic answer. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I could talk about oil for much longer, and maybe we will in the future, but your analysis was great. Paul Gooden is from 91 in London, portfolio manager, and Mohammed Dokrat, analyst at 91 in Cape Town. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.